The only guy who's going to be happy about this decision right now is Vladimir Putin. And maybe Kim Jong-il and or Jong-un in North Korea.
The Army plans to cut thousands of troops from J-Bear in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, dire predictions for shellfish in Alaska.
We're seeing changes in water chemistry faster in Alaska than really any other place around the world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Army said today it plans to cut 2,600 troops from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage and another 75 soldiers from Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. That would still leave J-Bear with more than 9,000 service members, but it slices two-thirds of the personnel from the 425th, the only airborne brigade in the Pacific. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Alaska's U.S. senators got the news from the Army's Vice Chief of Staff. Senator Lisa Murkowski vowed to fight it.
This is a decision that was made by the Pentagon that needs to be reversed by this president, needs to be reversed by the Secretary of Defense. And we're going to work to educate folks as to why it should be reversed.
Alaska's congressional delegation at multiple hearings has pressed Pentagon officials to acknowledge Alaska's strategic location on the globe and the importance of having troops who are Arctic ready. Murkowski says the Army's decision doesn't just harm the local economy.
This is bad from a national security perspective. This president made that decision that he was going to reduce force strength, and I think it was done at a time when the world was not as volatile as it is now.
Senator Dan Sullivan says the decision hurts American credibility overseas and damages the Army's ability to operate in the Arctic.
You cannot take troops anywhere, Marines, Army, and put them in the Arctic and say, operate. You have to have a culture. You have to have years of training. We have that, and we're removing it. The only guy who's going to be happy about this decision right now is Vladimir Putin. And maybe Kim Jong-il and or Jong-un in North Korea.
The reductions are part of the Army's effort to reduce its force by 40,000. The Army also announced its downsizing in Georgia and Hawaii. Sullivan says the Army should cut fat from the budget, not personnel.
There are other ways, and I'm going to start probing whether it's bloated headquarters, whether it's missions that seem to be redundant of other services, like the Army's Pacific Pathways mission, which looks an awful lot like the Marine Corps' mission.
Sullivan says he's put a hold on a Pentagon confirmation until he gets more information from the Army. If there's a silver lining, Sullivan says it's that part of the brigade will stay.
The entire unit's not being removed. They're still going to be, you know, it's going to be removed by two-thirds. But there's still going to be that capability to be able to build on if we get to what the Army sees as funding levels that can rebuild what is a very strategic force.
Joint Chiefs Chairman Martin Dempsey said at a hearing this week, the troop cuts have to come from somewhere. Dempsey blamed Congress and its budget cuts.
I will tell you this, Senator, we are familiar with the Congress telling us no on the reforms that we're making, not because we're trying to cut ourselves apart, but because we've got $1 trillion, that's a T, not a B, $1 trillion less in budget authority over 10 years. We've said from the beginning, it's a disaster.
Murkowski says the Alaska personnel cuts won't begin for another 18 months. She says she was told the Army hopes the reductions can come mostly from attrition, but the senator says that doesn't seem realistic. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
New research paints an unsettling picture of the future of shellfish in coastal Alaska. The effects of ocean acidification are worsening and could mean the end of hatcheries in the next 25 years if costly mitigation efforts aren't put in place. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
2040. That's the date put forward by researchers in the ongoing study.
It is dire.
Wiley Evans is a research associate at the NOAA Pacific Marine Environment Lab in Seattle and the University of Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center. He led the project, based at the Aleutic Pride Hatchery on the Kenai Peninsula. Right now, the hatchery has only a five-month window where ocean conditions are right for production.
You know, I have young children, and when I'm talking to the public about this, I typically will say that, you know, my kids are going to be graduating college when this optimal growth window potentially closes for the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery.
It was very, very alarming not knowing much about ocean chemistry. I know a lot more now than when we started, that's for sure.
Jeff Hatrick owns Aleutic Pride, which is situated at the head of Resurrection Bay in Seward.
Right now we have blue and red king crab, roughly 6 million sea cucumbers, 2 million cockles, 7 million little neck clams, 100,000 butter clams. We have roughly 300,000 Purple Hands rock scallops, abalone as well, and we have oysters and gooey ducks too.
It's currently the only full-time commercial shellfish hatchery in the state with on-site personnel, which made it a logical choice for data collection. Jeremy Mathis is a NOAA oceanographer who helped choose the site.
We had the opportunity last year to install really a state-of-the-art system that could monitor the water chemistry of the seawater that they were pumping into the hatchery on a continuous basis, and they would report out to us in what we call real time.
Ocean acidification is the name for certain changes in the ocean's chemistry due to higher levels of carbon dioxide. When seawater absorbs CO2, there's an increase in hydrogen ions, leading to more acidic water and lower levels of carbonate ions. Carbonate ions are crucial for organisms like clams and mussels to develop hard shells, and without shells, they aren't protected and can't survive. Mathis says Resurrection Bay is in a particularly vulnerable position because of certain environmental factors.
It gets a lot of freshwater input from not only the streams and little freshwater runoffs that come through there, but also quite a bit of meltwater from glaciers. And that unique water chemistry can actually exacerbate or worsen the ocean acidification effect.
Cold water, which is quicker to absorb CO2, combined with the presence of CO2-rich glacial melt, put Alaska as a whole at particular risk. Evans says those factors are natural, and it's a delicate balance. But as for the levels we're seeing here now,
it's not natural, and it's a large problem.
Humans and their carbon footprint have added serious amounts of CO2 to the atmosphere very quickly.
And that little bit of additional carbon dioxide can just push the system past thresholds to where you can't produce shellfish perhaps anymore without very, you know, serious mitigation strategies.
That's what worries Hetrick when he thinks about the future and the five-month production window at his hatchery that's on track to close completely in 25 years.
We don't really know what the full costs are going to be. There's going to be some. There'll be some capital costs. And there's going to be some operational costs. It's just going to be another thing that we have to do to produce shellfish.
Figuring out exactly what to do next is tricky, but Mathis says Alaska has to put in the effort immediately.
Unfortunately, Alaska is the canary in the coal mine for ocean acidification. We're seeing changes in water chemistry faster in Alaska than really any other place around the world. So it's our job now in the next few years to figure out what the magnitude and impact of those changes are going to be.
And he says, find a way to protect our fisheries before it's too late. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making a small fish processing business work in Bristol Bay.
Looking back, if you knew what it was going to be like, you would have been too intimidated. Or I personally would be too intimidated to do it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
Fire crews are defending the Koyukuk River village of Hughes from a wildfire approaching from the east. The Rock Fire is about 34,000 acres in size and showed moderate fire behavior yesterday. At last report, the fire was about 2 miles away from Hughes and on the same side of the Koyukuk River as the village. Crews conducted a burnout just to the east of Hughes to create a fire break. Public Information Officer Cale Casey at Alaska Fire Service headquarters on Fort Wainwright says managers and crews have had plenty of time to prepare for this situation.
Fire managers for that area have had the Hughes Fire, the Rock Fire number 336, on their radar for the past 2 weeks. They've been very concerned about it and very concerned about protecting the village of Hughes. The point protection efforts are working. You got the Midnight Sun hotshots in there. That's one of Alaska's finest hotshot crews, and they're going to do their job.
Casey says the burnout operation was successful at eliminating most of the unburned fuels between Hughes and the edge of the Rock Fire, and the threat of the fire entering the village has been significantly reduced. The Hughes Fire is barely inside the western border of the Tanana Fire Management Zone, though the use of aircraft based at Tanana or Fairbanks has been limited recently by smoky skies. Casey says at this point in the fire season, the use of aircraft to assist with firefighting operations is dependent on smoke conditions.
The question is the visibility, and Tanana itself has been struggling with visibility issues since the June 22nd fire bust, as has pretty much everywhere in the interior. When we can fly, we fly. We need a 3-mile visibility to get crews in on landing strips. If it's a fixed wing, if it's a helicopter, we're not going to fly if it's too smoky. So there have been windows as the weather has moderated over the last 2 weeks. When there's a window, we use it. When it's too unsafe, we don't fly.
A helicopter based at Bettles has been doing water drops on the fire and transporting crews. Any large aircraft needed to fight the fire would likely come from Fort Wainwright near Fairbanks. Many in Bristol Bay have dreamed of processing and selling their own catch, but there are lots of challenges. A few entrepreneurs around the bay, though, are making it work. KDLG's Hannah Colton caught up with one small processor. It's been in business for 4 years. She found the challenges can be overcome with some grit and elbow grease, a little humor, and a lot of attention to detail.
Amanda Waliszewski will admit she's a bit of a fish snob. When a salmon comes across her table at Nakeen Home Pack, she makes sure it is coddled every step of the way.
We're always looking for ways to not touch that fish. We changed our processing line, so instead of picking up the fish and handing it across 3 times, everyone's adjacent to each other. So, and then instead of having to pick up the fish and reach across the table, he just bridges it, slides it across the cutting board.
Waliszewski admits she might be a little oversensitive, but she says when you see thousands of fish go into fillets, you notice all the little bumps and bruises that can be prevented with a little TLC.
Because we see how beautiful they really can be if they're kept in nice condition. And that same exact fish that came off the boat and kind of got kicked around or that wasn't kept at temperature could have been the same fish that comes through like the ones you saw today. All their scales and just bright and shiny and perfect. They're perfect.
She's referring to a load of subsistence salmon she picked up from the beach earlier that day.
Do you have the weight on those?
Dave Alto was about 295.
In the calm before the storm of commercial fishing, Waliszewski is breaking in a mostly new crew. One of her experienced hands, Shoshana Wilhite, is helping train the 5 newcomers.
Yeah, they actually all picked it up super fast this year. Like, I'm impressed. And we've been so slow, but we've been getting some practice. So, you know, we've gradually gotten more fish every day. So it's been good.
The 9-person team can do about 500 pounds per hour. So it takes them about 40 minutes to get this delivery cut, vac-packed, and into the freezer. While they're cleaning their knives and tables, a truck pulls up in front. It's bringing another load of fish to cut, as well as a gift for the company.
This is a local lady here. She's donating her dog to us for the summer, so we have a bear dog. We have bear and fox, and when they catch a whiff of salmon, we'll have them all season. I guess his name is Jim. We'll give him a trial run. This will be his interview, Pam. If I'm going to hire him.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Pam Riddle has been bringing her subsistence fish to Amanda for 4 years now. Riddle does a lot of processing herself, canning, smoking, and salting. But when she wants frozen fillets to ship out of state, she leaves it to Nakeen Homepack.
I don't have the facility she does. And I send it to Washington for my daughter. And this makes it really easy. All I do is just bring her my fish. So, and Amanda's good people, really good people.
This is how Amanda likes to do business, by word of mouth, with friendly fishermen who come back year after year. And she said, when they're giving fillets to relatives or selling them at farmers markets, fishermen start to pay more attention to how they treat their fish, too.
And then the next year when they come back, they're really tapped into that. They want to know, how's the fish looking? Is it good? We bled all of these. Or, I went to this class this winter on seafood processing or handling or bleeding. And it's really cool to see them put the education part into it.
Of course, as every processor, big or small, discovers, there are challenges to starting a business in Bristol Bay. Waliszewski found it can be hard to find a mechanic during fishing season. It's complicated to ship up supplies and expensive to buy them locally.
It's kind of a thing where, looking back, if you knew what it was going to be like, you would have been too intimidated. Or I personally would be too intimidated to do it. So it's almost best not to know what's up ahead. You just go for it and hope somehow, by the grace of God, you make it to the end of the season and everybody gets paid and all the fish are well taken care of and you're done.
Waliszewski says by the end of each season, she'd be happy to never see another salmon again. But the feeling washes off quickly, like slime from extra tufts. By the time each May rolls around, she can't wait to get cutting again. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
The Alaska Marine Highway System has canceled this summer's sailings between Petersburg and northern Prince of Wales Island. But they'll happen next year, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The state ferry system announced the new route last year. It was supposed to connect terminals at South Mitkoff Island, about 25 road miles from Petersburg, and Kaufman Cove on northeast Prince of Wales. Marine Highway spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the route was a funding decision, not based on passenger need.
We used federal funds to construct both the Kaufman Cove terminal and the South Mitkoff terminal, and there could be a potential to have to pay back those federal funds if we actually don't use those terminals for ferry service.
The ferry docks were built last decade for routes that no longer exist. Together, they cost about $15 million. Woodrow says the small ferry Leconte was scheduled for this summer's monthly sailings, but it was docked for repairs during May and June.
Now the Malaspina is actually being late coming out of the yard, and the Malaspina is not expected to be delivered until the end of July, and because of that, the Leconte now is picking up service where the Malaspina normally would sail.
Few people made reservations for the August and September sailings, so they were canceled too. Woodrow says the ferry system will try again next summer, but with a different approach. It will hire the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, which has a backup ship, to sail the route. The IFA, which is separate from the state system, used to run a ferry between Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and South Mitkoff Island.
We've worked with the Federal Highway System, and they say that would meet the needs to show that we are trying to use those terminals.
Woodrow says the state will pay about $200,000 for the Kaufman-Mitkoff service. The money is left over from a road and bridge project on the Kenai Peninsula. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Clients of the Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage are agitating for change. They're frustrated with the way they are being treated at the shelter and with some of the policies. Catholic Social Services, which runs the shelter, is trying to work with them to improve the situation. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman reports.
Celia Harrison started staying at Brother Francis Shelter back in March when she felt like she could no longer safely stay in her housing in Soldotna. Since then, the former nurse has been writing about her experiences extensively on Facebook. Her posts include positive things like small kindnesses and detailed stories of staff at Brother Francis being loud in the middle of the night or her belongings being soaked by flooding in the shower room.
For a very long period of time, I would write at least one incident report every day about things that went on, things that the staff were doing, and other problems.
Harrison says her complaints made a difference. People are no longer allowed to bring food into the sleeping areas, and mats are laid out to give people more space. But Harrison says one thing has not improved. She says some staff members at the Brother Francis Shelter bully the clients.
I've even witnessed them setting people up to get a reaction so that they can use that reaction to throw people out. And it's not all of the staff, it's the bullies.
Harrison lists incidents of individuals being accused of drinking when they haven't and others being given special privileges. She's not alone in her concerns. Mary Burt and a half a dozen other individuals who use the facility started discussing the problems weeks ago. Burt says they tried to contact Catholic Social Services staff and received some follow-up, but not enough. Catholic Social Services Executive Director Lisa Aquino says the organization takes every complaint seriously. They log them and try to respond to them as best they can.
We never want our clients to feel bullied, period. When we have heard complaints about bullying or about questioning actions that our staff take, we always follow up on that. We always address that. If it's with a specific staff person, our management addresses it with them, and we also talk about the larger issues as a group and as a staff.
Aquino says in the past, they have terminated staff members if they are not a good fit for the program. But Aquino says the staff is working with a very diverse population with different mental and physical health needs. She says in the shelter, they have to find the balance of respect and safety for the 240 people who sleep there every night.
We face the challenge of trying to support all of our guests at the Brother Francis Shelter and treat them with dignity and respect and to provide them with the individual care that they need as a person, but at the same time thinking of the overall health and well-being of all of our clients at the shelter.
To do that, they train staff about the culture of poverty, mental health issues, trauma-informed care, and de-escalating conflicts. But Aquino says with fiscal, legal, and social constraints, they can't monitor all areas at all times. Mary Burt says she has sent Aquino an email requesting a community dialogue at the shelter about the guests' experiences with bullying. If it doesn't happen, they'll hold a public protest. Burt and Harrison have already contacted the mayor's office. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Living witnesses to the forced relocation of West Coast Japanese Americans during World War II are growing fewer every year. Many who were incarcerated are in their 80s and 90s now. Their descendants and historians want to preserve the memory and lessons from the unjust internment. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi tagged along on an annual pilgrimage to the Minidoka internment camp in southern Idaho to find out more.
We need to take a quick detour to the past before dwelling in the present. You know about the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. Less well known is that in its wake, President Roosevelt signed an executive order to summarily round up Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans living along the West Coast. Minidoka was one of 10 main camps built to confine civilians of Japanese ancestry during the war. It held people from coastal Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, most of whom were U.S. citizens.
So yeah, I hope you guys all have some good walking shoes on.
The former internment camp is now managed by the National Park Service, and it's also the destination for an annual pilgrimage.
The fire of the potbelly stove was in the corner, and then we had a triple bunk on this side.
Sam Kido Jr. was 5 years old when his family was crammed into one room in a barrack block guarded by soldiers amid the dusty sagebrush of southern Idaho.
And then a double bunk on this side.
At its peak, Minidoka internment camp held nearly 10,000 people. Keto hails from southeast Alaska. He says it was his daughter's idea to join the organized pilgrimage to the site. Hope Keto is a nurse in Bellingham.
It's something that I always heard about growing up, but it's not something that anyone ever talked about for a while. And I don't think that the magnitude of it was ever expressed. So it was worth coming with him.
When you get new people or younger people involved, and what happens is that your mind starts thinking about what should have been better for your parents and your generations. Well, that's great, you know, but you can't rewrite history. You live history the way with the cards that were dealt to you, and then you make sure it doesn't happen again.
Mary Tanaka Abo was held at the camp when she was a child.
Being here made me ashamed of being Japanese when I was young.
Abo came on the pilgrimage with her daughter and two grandchildren. This was her second trip back.
And so just being around people is always good.
Nearly 200 pilgrims journeyed to the site on the final weekend in June. Co-organizer Biff Brigman says this was the 11th edition of the Minidoka pilgrimage. He says the idea from its genesis carries on today.
We're losing the Iseis, the first generation, and Niseis, the second generation of Japanese Americans, and we're afraid of losing those stories. That's one of the things that pushes us to do it annually, to keep doing it.
The National Park Service superintendent in charge at Minidoka also feels the urgency to capture more voices of witnesses before they go silent. This is Judy Geniak.
It would be incredible for us to figure out a way to have young people interviewing, whether it's their great-grandfather or it's their next-door neighbor. And we know that people from the camp went all over the United States after they left the camp.
Meanwhile, the physical remains of the Minidoka camp, which nearly disappeared, are being resurrected. A guard tower, barracks, mess hall, and fire station have been rebuilt or restored in recent years. Geniak says a visitor center is in the works, as are plans to recreate the central baseball field. I'm Tom Bonsi at the Minidoka National Historic Site near Twin Falls, Idaho.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed our stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Tim Bodoni in Galena, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Tom Bonsi in Idaho. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council is working to protect Alaska's oceans ecosystems and promote thriving coastal communities. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.